The unique sounds of tonight's featured artist, Shetland-born saxophonist Rachel Cohen and her quartet, recorded at the 2015 Glasgow Jazz Festival. More from that performance later on the show. Well, let's get things rolling now with the former Miles Davis guitarist Mike Stern, who you may have heard interviewed recently on Jazz Lineup. He's had a colourful career spanning over several decades, and his album called All Over the Place was a real star-studded affair and featured some serious jazz heavyweights such as trumpeter Randy Brecker, saxophonist Chris Potter and bassist and vocalist Esperanza Spalding. His music mixes up funk, blues, jazz and African music, and the track we're about to hear called Cameroon is named after the West African country which has produced so many legendary bass players, including Etienne Mbappé, Guy Nsangu, Noel Ikwabi, and the one featured on this track, the multi-instrumentalist and vocalist Richard Bona. I'd say this style is a perfect example of world jazz fusion, and it's one of those catchy melodies that stays with you long after you've heard it. This is Cameroon. From Mike Stern's album All Over the Place, that was Cameroon, featuring the vocals and bass playing of Richard Bona, alongside Bob Franceschini on saxophone, Jim Beard on piano and Hammond B3 organ, Dave Weckel on the drums, Tim Kuiper on percussion, and Mike Stern, of course, wailing on the guitar. The album is out on the Heads Up label. Well, it's time now for our monthly feature where we shine a light on a classic recording of recent times. I'm pleased to be joined by fellow broadcaster and journalist Kevin Legendre for Now's the Time. Kevin, you've unearthed something really funky this month. Tell us a bit more about Eddie Russ and why this album is so important.
Eddie Russ is a keyboard player who's one of those relatively obscure figures in jazz who isn't a big name, but played with big names. Mm. He worked with people like Sarah Vaughan, Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz, Benny Golson, So some really, really top people. And he was never signed to a major label. He just recorded for small independents. And in the mid-70s, he recorded an album called See the Light, which is what we're focusing on, which really is a classic. And I suppose totally sums up, it really encapsulates what became known as jazz funk. So it's fusion of jazz with electric sounds, very funky rhythms, very bluesy, very soulful rhythms, where he's really bringing together the music of the soul giants, Earth, Wind & Fire, jazz giant Herbie Hancock, and the other great jazz organ player and keyboard player as well, Charles Earland.
Brilliant. Sounds like a great combination. OK, let's hear the first track, and it's Eddie Russ. And the album is called See the Light, and this is the title track. We'll be right back. A funky 7/8 time fill there from Eddie Russ, taken from his album See the Light, and it's our featured recording today. So, Kevin, give me some more information about Eddie Russ. You said he played with Sarah Vaughan and Benny Golson. Do you think it was an easy transition for him from sort of being, I guess, more straight ahead to being a fusion player?
Absolutely, because he was always interested in electric keyboards. In the 60s or early 70s, at least, he started playing Rhodes, and he had a really, really popular track called The Lope Song, which became very big in the 80s when acid jazz happened. That was a sort of rare groove that came back, where he's playing Fender Rhodes. It's very, very funky, very bluesy. So the blues and the funk and the soul was there in his music right from the beginning, and I think he naturally embraced Fender Rhodes, polyphonic synthesizers, all of the Arp Odysseys and Korgs that people like Herbie and other keyboard players were using in the 70s. So the kind of the soul and the blues was always there in his music. It was just a question of incorporating the new sounds.
Mm. And the album was recorded in Detroit's United Sound Studios, and that's quite famous for George Clinton concocting his mind-boggling funkadelic
P-funk.
Yeah, so an appropriate place to record, do you think? Yeah. I mean, do you think he picked that out on purpose, just for the sort of heritage and feel of the place?
Detroit is one of those really, really key pivotal cities in the history of black music. Obviously Motown, but also jazz as well, soul, blues, and the heritage of the city. Mm. The funkiness of the city, you definitely hear it in this music. So, yeah, it makes perfect sense for him to actually be recording in Detroit, even though he was originally from Pittsburgh. If you're dancing to this record as well, and you hear that change in contrast...
Yeah, that, you pull out new moves. Yeah,
absolutely. It just it just inspires you. I mean, that was the thing. We used to dance to this record a lot.
It's very layered, isn't it? Jazz, funk, fusion like this. And it goes on, doesn't it? Lots of tracks are going off.
It was all about colours and people experimenting with technology as well. If you think about that time in the 70s when the use of synthesizers became very important in jazz, and this is the perfect example of that, really. And the most important thing is that this record is 45 years old, and it was recorded in the mid 70s, and it still sounds, as you said right at the top of the feature, incredibly fresh.
Tell us about the final track, It Made Me Smile. It's so lush and sexy, sultry 70s, isn't it, really?
I mean, it's a very slinky groove. This is Salem good. Avenue, and it's a real contrast to See the Light. So this takes the tempo right down. This is a very soulful, kind of gospel-tinged ballad.
You didn't dance to this, though, did you?
I think we may have smooched to this. This is a slow dance classic, a slow jam, a proper slow jam. But the saxophone in this, as well as the female vocal, the very leisurely feel to it, just it makes it a really appealing piece of music.
Brilliant. OK, from Eddie Russ's album See the Light, let's get really mellow with Salem Avenue.
Oh,
Eddie Russ, today's featured artist, and that's from today's featured album, selected by Kevin Legendre, who's still with me. Kevin, that was fantastic. Thank you for bringing that in.
Very happy to share the music.
Well, please stick around, Kevin, for tonight's concert set with saxophonist Rachel Cohen, which was recorded at the 2015 Glasgow Jazz Festival. I know you were there hosting the jazz lineup stage, so it would be great to get some insights about that set from you.
Absolutely. Happy to talk about that.
This is Jazz Lineup on BBC Radio 3 with me, Claire Martin, on FM, online and on digital radio. Time now for a report by jazz writer Sebastian Scotney. He's been out and about tracking down some connections between jazz and sport, and cricket in particular. And he finds some interesting results.
There are times when the right thing to do is to leave winter and discontent a long way behind and just imagine yourself back in the summer. We put together a journey to find a few jazz and cricket links, and it starts in perhaps an unlikely place for jazz, which is just behind the pavilion at Lord's in St John's Wood in London, where there was an anniversary to celebrate in the summer of 2015. The band that's been playing Dixieland jazz at the Temple of Cricket has been marking its 20th season there. They're called the Outswingers, and they appear during every lunchtime interval of the test matches at Lord's on the edge of what is called the Harris Garden. They all play portable acoustic instruments. It's outdoors music, no electrics and no sheet music to deal with. The band was started by saxophonist John Barnes, and these days it's led by tuba player and occasional vocalist Graham Reed. Graham Reed has been in the band all the way through from the start. I went and visited him in Leytonstone. Just an aside, his house happens to be just round the corner from the late, great Canadian trumpeter and composer Kenny Wheeler's house, which now has a plaque on it. And in fact, Graham Reed told me, he used to be occasionally roped in as a copyist for the genius Kenny Wheeler himself. I asked Graham Reed about how the Outswingers band had got started.
Someone in the pavilion one day was talking about putting some live music on, and someone else said, oh, I think John does something like that, rather vaguely. John said, yes, of course I do. I can put something together for you. And that was the initial approach.
One obvious person there who was also a big cricket fan was Campbell Burnett, wasn't he?
Campbell, of course, was a member of the MCC as well. And as you say, an obvious choice for trombone. Spike Robinson, American tenor player, who was a lifelong member of Essex. Surprisingly, for an American to be so keen on cricket, Spike was approached and jumped at the chance, of course. Alan Elston, also very keen on watching the cricket, was a suitable choice for trumpet player. And I've played with John originally, I think, in the Midnight Follies Orchestra. John rang me up and said, look, we've got this job. Do you fancy coming and playing? And of course, as soon as I heard who was in the band, it was an obvious yes. And a free ticket to go and watch some cricket to boot.
John Barnes was always the entertainer. In the early days, according to a book by Jim Godbolt, he used to pin the set lists to the trees and put punning, misleading, groaning cricket allusions there in the titles of standards. So You Go to My Head became You Throw to My Head, Willow Weep for Me became Willow Sweep for Me, and so on. Thank you. That trombonist you can hear on Basin Street Blues is Roy Williams, who took over from Campbell Burnap after that very popular trombonist and broadcaster had died. In fact, the years have really taken their toll on this lineup.
The mantle has fallen on me. John Barnes's wife, Pat, rang me up in the season after he'd had his rather sad stroke and said that John was keen for the music to continue at Lord's, and I was the obvious choice to carry on. Would I like to do it? So I said, yes, OK, that's fine.
Ron Drake is on tenor.
Yes, Ron's a lifelong cricket fan, I believe, from Derby, mm-hmm. Derbyshire. Wears his Derby tie to Lord's. Of course, Roy Williams from Yorkshire, who is also a fount of knowledge during the match with statistics about this and that.
We think of cricket as part of our summer, and the Outswingers are a band from here, but to state the obvious, test matches wouldn't happen at all unless there were teams travelling here from far-flung parts of the Commonwealth. Playing at a hotel near the Houses of Parliament, I found a singer and guitar duo. They are both North Londoners, but they have their origins in different cricketing countries, and they both have their associations with the sport too. The singer is Nina Ferro from Melbourne, and the guitarist is Dominic Grant, whose eminent father was born in Guyana. The two work a lot together, and another duo album is on the way. It's music with sunshine in it.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you. You'd feel like heaven to touch. Oh, I want to hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived, and I thank God I'm alive. 'Cause you're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.
Australians do tend to see the world differently. Surely, I asked Nina Ferro, sport must be so much a part of the backdrop to life. It's hard to avoid, isn't it?
I think it's part of being an Australian, to be honest. Australians are so mad for their sports that most big shows tend to be centred around a big sporting event, and they take it very seriously. And I have been a part of some pretty big sporting events over the past, you know, over the course of my career to date.
Some examples?
Well, the first one that springs to mind was, I think it was 2002, and it was the Boxing Day test between England and Australia, and I got given the national anthem, God Save the Queen. So the other girl got to sing Advance Australia Fair, and I came out and sang God Save the Queen, and what I didn't realise at the time was that it was being beamed live to England. So everyone in England saw it, no one in Australia saw it, except for Hugh Jackman, bless his heart, because he was in the audience. It was incredible walking out onto the MCG, which people who know their sports know that the MCG is one of the larger and one of the best sporting arenas in the world, actually. And so, yes, that was full. I think it was 75,000 people or thereabouts. I think capacity is over 100,000.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.
The Sydney 2000 Olympics, I had the pleasure of performing at Homebush, where the Athletes Centre was and where all the main people were sort of staying. And there was a stage right outside the Athletes Centre. So for 16 nights straight through the Olympics, I performed every night with a band. And we had an amazing time. We met so many incredible people. Sydney was just a buzz. I saw that again here in London in 2012. But being more a part of the Sydney Olympics, just the incredible feeling of it all. So I really do think that music and the sports go so well together.
I love you, baby, and if it's quite all right, I need you, baby, to warm the lonely. I love you, baby. Trust in me when I say, oh, pretty baby, don't bring me
I was curious to find out if she thought whether there were any things in common between musicians and sports people.
Well, you've got to be self-motivated. You know, if you don't get yourself up in the morning and train, if you don't get up and practice your instrument, there's no one else who can do it for you. It's very self-motivated. And it's also a long-term thing. Most people who are excelling in their field, whether it be music or sport, tend to start from a very early age and put in a hell of a lot of time and a hell of a lot of effort and a lot of mental power, because it takes your brain to actually do all this stuff.
King Cricket, Garfield Sobers is his name. King Cricket, King Cricket, Sobers is his name.
The guitarist Dominic Grant is the son of the late Cy Grant, the Guyanese polymath, actor, musician, writer, poet and broadcaster, who died in 2010 at the age of 90. Dominic Grant himself has his own sporting connections. He plays a lot of tennis. In fact, he sees a strong affinity of guitar players with tennis and feels in good company, because guitar gods Jim Hall and Paco de Lucia were both, he told me, tennis obsessives. I also asked Dominic Grant about the cricketing calypsos which his dad used to write for British television, such as King Cricket, dedicated to Garfield Sobers, who was the captain of the all-conquering West Indies teams of the 60s, and The Constantine Calypso, which tells the story of the dignified Leary Constantine, who became a politician and was appointed a peer and did important work in race relations.
West Indies field 15 men, the king of the game. Garfield Sobers is his name, for cricket and West Indies. Long may he reign. King Cricket, Garfield Sobers is his name. King Cricket, Sobers is his name.
According to Dominic Grant, his father wasn't crazy about calypsos. They were written because he got the commission to do them. But it has to be said that both of these songs make the incredible dignity and greatness of Sobers and of Constantine stand out. The songs really tell the story of their achievements, both on and off the pitch. Moving on, I also spoke to a British-born jazz bassist who had a different role in cricket. He once played it professionally. Before he moved to America as a musician, Orlando Le Fleming, he now lives in Brooklyn, was under contract to Somerset and also played minor counties cricket for Devon. When he got to New York, he had quite a few years playing in Jane Monheit's band, and he has a successful trio, the Owl Trio, with fellow Brit New Yorker Will Vinson and the Norwegian guitarist Lager Lundt. I asked Orlando Le Fleming, on a crack league phone line from New York, if things that he had learnt playing competitive sport had helped him in the music business.
That sporting pressure, you know, did help me with the music. Dealing with high pressure situations and guys who are basically bullying you a bit, you know, on stage, you know, and learning how to handle it and be thick skinned.
Another bassist who also has a journey from sport into music and who is of similar age, just 2.5 years younger than Orlando Le Fleming, is Michael Janish. There isn't actually a cricket connection here. I just like the idea of them as some kind of doppelgangers who started off in sport on opposite sides of the Atlantic and ended up travelling across it, and once they'd got to the other side, each settled and developed a substantial career in music. Le Fleming's life as a young man went west, to Brooklyn. Michael Janish's went east, to Surrey. Michael Janish was a running back in American football, and he was on a full sports scholarship at an American university, and he was also a 400-metre runner. I interviewed him a few years ago, and he told me that his sporting career had ended, and very suddenly. He told me that in a practice session, a 340-pound defensive tackle had landed with his knee on Janish's hamstring and had ripped it apart. Janish remembered the pain. For 3 months he couldn't walk and there was bruising, and the university withdrew his sports scholarship. Ever since I've known Michael Janish, that story has stayed with me and must go some way to explaining his level of drive, energy, stamina and his work rate. Janish runs the record label Whirlwind Recordings and has his own second album out. What you're hearing is one particularly busy track called Chakaraka. Features Colin Stranahan on drums and Jason Palmer on trumpet. And to me at least, it has the focus and the energy of the team locker room running right through it. This story about jazz and sport could have gone, in fact, it could still go a lot further. I've had some very helpful conversations with composer and band leader John Altman, whose father and uncle were both big band players and serious club cricketers too. John knows everybody in music and in cricket. And then there's the story of Doug Insole, former chair of the Cricket Selectors for England, who has been responsible for getting a lot of cricketers interested in jazz. Insole was a school classmate of a central figure in British jazz, John Dankworth, in Walthamstow. But this feature is running out of time, and a good place to end is with jazz musicians marking one of the great moments, one of the absolute high points of cricket, when the spin bowler Jim Laker virtually beat the Australians single-handed at the Old Trafford Ashes Test in 1956. What Laker achieved was to take 19 of the Australians' 20 wickets. It was an incredible feat, and his record stands to this day. In fact, it will probably never be beaten. The tune is just a B-flat blues, and they called it Laker's Day. It has saxophonists Tubby Hayes, Ronnie Scott, and Harry Klein in exuberant mode. Listen out for the end. There's a moment when the whole band imagine themselves as a group of fielders watching on, and they're appealing to the umpire as Laker takes yet another Australian wicket. They all shout, "How's that?"
Laker's Day from the Tony Crombie Quintet, featuring Tubby Hayes, Ronnie Scott and Harry Klein, rounding off that report from Sebastian Scotney. We're coming up next tonight, our concert set recorded at the 2015 Glasgow Jazz Festival, featuring alto saxophonist and composer Rachel Cohen. Originally hailing from the Shetland Islands, Rachel won a scholarship to enrol in jazz studies at the Birmingham Conservatoire, and then she immersed herself in the Birmingham jazz scene. In 2012, she made the bold career move to London, and since then, she's been signed to the Whirlwind Recordings label and has received much critical acclaim for her beautifully lyrical and controlled playing style. Well, I'm still joined by Kevin Lejeune. Kevin, you were at the gig. Paint a picture of the concert at the festival.
It took place at the Rio, which is a lovely little pop-up basement club right in the heart of the Merchant City, and it was a full day of music. We recorded four other bands, which climaxed with the James Taylor Quartet, did a storming set. We had this lovely collaboration between pianist Zoe Rahman and saxophonist Laura McDonald. We had the very, very upbeat and very funny, very engaging Swiss trio Vain. And then, yeah, they were great. Such humour and real inventive playing in the music. And we also had a really exciting BBC introducing band called Trio HSK. So it was a real feast of music. Mm. And Rachel played a lovely set, as you say, very lyrical. Can hear the influence of Lee Konitz. Really, really precise, lovely interplay within the group, but very mature as well.
So, yeah,
very impressive.
I thought she sounded great. Well, Kevin, I know you also interviewed Rachel while you were in Glasgow, so before we hear her performing, let's have a listen to that interview. And you start by asking her how long her band has been together.
Well, I've been playing with these guys since I moved to London. I moved to London about 2.5 years ago. And I met Bruno Heinen there, the pianist, Mark Lewandowski, the bass player there. Doug Huff, actually, I've known since Birmingham. We were both at the Birmingham Conservatoire. So I know them coming from different areas. The specific band tonight, anyway, isn't actually my usual lineup. I usually have Phil Robson on guitar, you know, the album band. But these guys are absolutely fantastic to play with, you know.
How long does it take to feel comfortable with musicians and think, right, okay, these are the ones who are going to work in a group with me?
It varies, actually. Sometimes you can play once or twice with people and you know there's the chemistry there, there's the, you know, there's potential for a lot, you know, but sometimes you have to work with people for quite a while, you know, and it can be worth it as well, you know, so everybody's different, but with these guys it happens near on straight away, I think, vibe-wise. You know, we got on playing-wise, you know, pretty much straight away, I think.
And the quartet is one of the classic lineups in jazz. If you think of all the groups who've played in quartets, all the great band leaders who've had quartets over the years, what do you like about the format?
It gives you a lot of support. You know, when you play in a quartet, whether it's piano or guitar, actually, I mean, piano in this circumstance, for these gigs, you know, there's a huge amount of harmonic support there, and what that gives you is lots of different ideas for your own harmonic kind of contribution, you know, and it gives you a lot of scope and a lot of options for playing, you know.
So your background is unusual, to say the least. You're one of the few jazz musicians that I know who come from the Shetland Islands. Tell me how you discovered the music over there.
Well, I've been playing piano since I was really young, but I picked up the saxophone when I was about 9. I had the option of the saxophone or the violin, and I made the obvious choice in my eyes anyway, and I went for the saxophone. We were quite lucky in Shetland, actually. The music scene up there is actually a lot bigger than people think. The folk scene, anyway, is really big up there. But the jazz scene, we had a lot of visiting bands. So the Fife Youth Jazz Orchestra, for instance, came up to Shetland when I was really quite young, playing in my school jazz band. And that was a big thing, actually, for us. You know, we worked with them and workshops and rehearsals and things. And from then, just getting introduced, just little things, people giving you a different record to listen to, or people giving you, you know, and also the instrument that I played lends itself naturally anyway, no matter where you are, there's always going to be that connection to jazz when you play the saxophone, there's always going to be that thing there, so it's always, you're always going to have to check it out at some point, you know, so I think that's where it started.
Fantastic. It's great to hear you playing here, and we look forward to the next new music that you bring to us as well. Rachel, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Great to hear those insights from today's featured artist, Rachel Cohen. And Kevin, thanks for that interview, and thanks for sticking around.
My pleasure.
Well, let's enjoy the performance now, recorded on Saturday, June the 27th, on the Jazz Lineup stage at the Rio Pop-Up Club as part of the 2015 Glasgow Jazz Festival. The lineup features Mark Lewandowski on double bass, Bruno Heinen on piano and Doug Huff on the drums, and Rachel Cohen on alto sax. Here's Rachel opening with her own composition, The Manor.
Thank you.
Ending tonight's concert set, that was Green, featuring Rachel Cohen on alto sax, Mark Lewandowski on double bass, Bruno Heinen on piano and Doug Hoff on the drums. Recorded on Saturday, June the 27th at the Jazz Lineup stage at the 2015 Glasgow Jazz Festival. Well, time's almost up, but let's go out now on a romantic note with something from pianist Alex Hutton's Magna Carta Suite, which is out on Fire Records. Inspired by the woodlands where he enjoys his daily dog walks and where the Magna Carta was indeed signed, let's hear Alex on the piano with bass player Yuri Gulabev and drummer Asif Circus with Self-Made Man. Till next time from me, Claire Martin. Bye-bye.
That was Self-Made Man by the Alex Hutton Trio, ending this week's Jazz Lineup. The programme was presented by Claire Martin and produced in Glasgow by Sushil K. Dade. For more information on Jazz Lineup, go to the programme page via the Radio 3 website. And there's more jazz here on BBC Radio 3, Geoffrey Smith at midnight tonight, and then, of course, from 4 o'clock next Saturday afternoon. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 6 o'clock and time for Opera on 3. I'm David Cornett in London, but we join listeners now worldwide for the next in this season's Live from the Met.
We are live at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. I'm Mary Jo Heath, and in this Saturday matinee, one of today's most acclaimed dramatic sopranos is making a highly anticipated appearance in Puccini's Turandot, Nina Stemma, who sings the title role of the proud Chinese princess. Starring opposite her are tenor Marco Berti as Khalaf, the mystery prince, and soprano Anita Hartig as the courageous slave girl, Liu. Paolo Carignani conducts this resplendent opera, which is also being transmitted today into movie theaters worldwide live in HD. During intermission, HD host Renee Fleming will speak with our stars backstage and will bring you the opera quiz featuring soprano Barbara Fritoli. Stay with us.
And we'll be rejoining New York in a moment. The Metropolitan Opera broadcast season is supported by Toll Brothers, the Annenberg Foundation, the Neubauer Family Foundation, and the Vincent A. Stabile Endowment for Broadcast Media. And it's broadcast here through an arrangement with the European Broadcasting Union. So now we go back to New York for the introduction to Act One of Puccini's Turandot.
Hi, Mary Jo Heath, and commentator Ira Siff is with me. Ira, how interesting that for Puccini's final opera, Turandot, he turned to a story unlike any he'd used before, a fairy tale set in legendary China.
Well, he was drawn to it because he loved the idea of depicting the humanizing of the title character, the icy princess Turandot, showing how she's transformed through love. But he struggled with this in the end, and ironically, that challenge kept him from finishing the opera before he died.
Right, it had to be completed by Franco Alfano. Now, the role of the slave girl, Liu, is more what we think of as a typical Puccini heroine. Turandot is different from his other heroines, both vocally and dramatically. She's often sung by sopranos who do Wagner, like Nina Stemma.
Yes, Stemma is revered for her Wagner performances around the world. Her New York appearances have been all too infrequent, so this is a major event.
Yeah, and she's singing to a sold-out house today. Puccini worked on this opera for about 3 years, from 1921 to 1924. There are plenty of lush melodies, like the tenor aria Nessun Dorma. And I know that you and I are both fascinated by this score, which has parts that are quite harmonically adventurous.
Well, he employed elements like bitonality, two keys at once, whole tone scales, pentatonic passages based on five-note scales, like you often find in folk music. And as with his Madama Butterfly, he incorporated some authentic Asian music. For Turandot, it was melodies he heard from a friend's Chinese music box, and we'll hear more about that during the intermission, as well as some sheet music that was supplied for him by his publisher.
Right. Well, in general, his vision of ancient imperial China is